I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Krishnan Venkatesh. He's a tutor at St. John's College and teaches also in their new Summer Film Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. Now, I think this is the second year of the Film Institute.
Yes.
It's a summer program that takes basically a kind of great books approach to great films. What does this actually look like?
We have two classes basically in the summer. One is the evening class, the seminar, which is seminars or very intense discussions on a body of film by, I think we're doing like 4 to 6 different directors this year. And then we're going to have another class that involves very detailed study of 4 films, 2 by Orson Welles and 2 by Alfred Hitchcock. So on the one hand, we have a class that is very detailed and very slow in studying a film. And on the other hand, we have a class that works to get a deep understanding of a broad spectrum of films.
Right. Now, in both cases, we're talking about becoming, the way we become better readers of books, becoming better readers of films. What are the skills involved in becoming a better reader of films?
That's a good way of putting it. To become literate in films, at least more literate in films, we look at if there's a storyline. You know, obviously we look at the storyline, but most people stop there at plot. What we're interested in is how the storyline fits in together with all the other dimensions of film. The composition, the lighting, the way the camera works and behaves, all those directorial decisions that we're not usually aware of when we're watching a film.
And which presumably amplify the meaning of the film in all kinds of poetic ways.
Yes, all kinds of ways. Yeah, poetic, philosophical, even narrative. Things might be shown that are not said, that you might not pick up until the third viewing.
What are some examples of that?
For example, last year we did the Karl Dreyer's great film, The Passion of Joan of Arc. And the film is a marvel in its conciseness. Sometimes you don't notice that something terrible has happened until about the third time in the film, when you pick up just the way people look at each other. Nothing is said about it. Right? But you know from that somebody has been carted off to execution, you know, or something terrible like that.
Right.
Yeah.
These are skills that make you a better reader. They're also skills that would make you a better filmmaker, I would think. Do you get young or aspiring filmmakers in the classes?
Yes, we get quite a few. We had screenwriters. We had a couple of aspiring directors last year. So a lot of people who are interested in making films come to us for that. But I think that primarily what you say is right, you know, that we're trying to cultivate a kind of critical intelligence with regard to the moving image that we cultivate with regard to the page. And we think it's so important in our day when we're so inundated with moving images from every direction that in a way we can't really be free minds if we're merely the victims of them. You know, if we can't
right.
read them, if we can't take a critical position towards them.
So there's really a sense of, I mean, there are media literacy organizations that teach young people how advertisements are designed to get into their psychology and make them do things and stuff like that. And this is kind of another level of that, in a way.
That's right. I think most of the moving images that are thrown at us aim to produce one simple effect, right? Make us feel fear, make us feel horny, make us buy something. You know,
right.
Usually make us buy something.
Right.
Yeah. And the very greatest films are not that simple. You know, so in a way, we are able in this program to savor the most thoughtful, the most interesting, the most rich creations of the moving image. But incidentally, we also know how to read things that purport to be transparent.
Now, how did you develop the love for film that you have and that you bring to this course?
Well, I remember the moment when my mind was blown by a film, and I was 14, and a friend of mine in high school, I was in England in high school, told me that we had to go to London to see Jean Cocteau's Beauty and the Beast. Okay, so I had never heard of the film. I had vaguely read some poems by Cocteau, but I went with him. And when we went to an art cinema on Oxford Street in London, and I was completely flabbergasted by the beauty, the mysteriousness and the radiance of this film. I'd never seen anything like that before. From that time on, there was no going back. And listeners might be interested to know that Jean Cocteau's Beauty and the Beast is actually playing this week at the Jean Cocteau.
At the Jean Cocteau.
Yeah, yeah, don't miss it.
Yeah, well, now I'm not going to miss it now that you've said that. Isn't that funny? Films that change your life. Did you see it at the time in a kind of multidimensional way? I mean, as both storytelling and as visual composition and some of the things you just were talking about?
No, not at all. I was just blown away by the beauty. I had never seen anything like that. I had no idea that there was something like that out there. You know, I had only seen commercial cinema or what was on TV.
Right.
Luckily for me, at home there was the BBC. Right, and the BBC would do crazy things like run Scandinavian films at prime time on Saturday night every week. So that really helped me to follow up.
Very interesting.
And I started reading a lot about film too.
Now, is there a kind of maybe evolving, but nevertheless a kind of canon of great films the way there is of great books?
Yes, I think there is. There's a body of people that that are regarded as great directors, you know, authors, and they're surprising. It's surprising how many of them there are. It's really frustrating when we're planning this curriculum, how many people we'd like to study but have to leave out because that would be doing too much. I mean, it's astonishing. Every country seems to have 10 or so major directors who to our minds are of the same artistic stature as, say, you know, William Faulkner or Pablo Picasso. You know, these are creative giants. And the more we work with them, the more we're just stunned by the richness.
And we're not just talking Europe and the U.S., but there are great Iranian films. There are great Chinese films.
Yes, yes. And many of them we don't get the chance to see. Even the silent films, that they're not available for viewing. I keep reading up about great silent films by directors that people don't hear about, like Abel Gantz, you know, great directors, but they're not available anywhere to see. And every week I keep turning up somebody's recommendation for a really great film that I haven't even heard of.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So they're not available anywhere? I mean, are they like disintegrating in a can somewhere?
No, something like that. People have to find the can. People have to, you know, make a good copy of the film. Restore them, and then produce them somehow on DVD. And when only, you know, 20 people are likely to buy it, then for most distribution companies, I guess it's not worth it.
Very interesting. Yeah. Now, we have in literature and in the St. John's curriculum, every book has an author. It was written by somebody. A film is, by its own nature, a collaborative production, so we have not only directors, but the screenwriters, the actors. You had to choose the director when you're talking about the filmmaker. I mean, it's almost arbitrary, whether it's the director or the writer or the actor.
Almost arbitrary. I think we're looking for the unifying critical intelligence, the unifying creative intelligence, the one that makes the last decision about how the thing is to be. I think most of the time that still remains the director. You know, somebody else might provide the creative impulse, you know, the idea, but the director is the one who says, yeah, that belongs in the film.
Right.
Yeah. Sometimes, say with more, you know, films like Laurel and Hardy, for example, that might be a case where the actors might be the authors of the film, or some Peter Sellers movies.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, very interesting. Now, are they all narrative films? Are there also documentaries?
These are mostly narrative films. We're saving non-narrative films for another time, I think.
But within narrative films, there's still a lot of variations. Silent and talkies, short films, and full-length films.
Yeah, linear narratives, non-linear narratives, you know, fragmented, you know, philosophical narratives, silent comedy.
Right.
Right, yeah.
Now, do you watch the films together as the group, and do you talk about, for example, the quality of the print, the size of the screen, the sound? Those are all part of the experience. Or are people like home watching them on their computers?
Well, we were lucky enough last year to have Jason Silverman of the CCA work with us in showing most of these films on the big screen. And this year, that's going to happen as well as the screen.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and so we're going to be able to see most of these films on the big screen. And that is an amazing opportunity. So, for example, the Joan of Arc that we saw last year, on the small screen, you don't notice how... most of the film is shown in close-up, right? So on the small screen, you don't notice how her face shimmers like the sea. It's like watching the wind playing on the sea. And every tear has expression. Her eyeball has expression. You know, so to see the film well projected on the big screen is, it's about 50% of the experience.
Very interesting. Yeah. And it also makes you think about the film's root in painting and other visual art forms.
That's right. Many of the early directors that we studied last summer, the ones from the 1920s and the 30s, were very steeped in the history of Western art, very steeped in literature. So often the compositions would evoke whole histories of paintings.
Now, you are a tutor at St. John's, and you teach Plato and Aristotle and Heidegger and all the people who belong to the great books canon. And all the tutors at St. John's, they're not called professors, they're called tutors, do that. They teach a whole variety of science and literature and philosophy and so on. And now here is film. Do the tutors self-select to be in the Film Institute? In other words, do you have a bunch of tutors who are major film aficionados teaching?
Yeah, basically right now, yeah. But I think the interest will spread. It's like when the Eastern Classics program began. We had a small bunch of tutors who were passionate about it. And now a third of the faculty has taught in that program. So I have confidence that this will actually spread just because the films are so obviously great.
Now, there's also a reading component to the film, program at St. John's. And as we know, I mean, I, a former St. John's student, you read the original texts and you don't read supplementary material in general. What is the nature of these readings that you're reading along with the films?
Some of them are meditations or critical meditations on film set by major thinkers on film, like the French critic André Bazin. And those are really great little essays. I think they can stand by themselves whether you're interested in film or not. And then works like Tarkovsky's book, Sculpting in Time, which to me is the best book written about film and one of the best books written about art. So that for me, that goes in the list of top five of books written about art. So it's a great book. Autobiographies of filmmakers, you know, Bergman or Bresson talking about their films. Not all of it is, great and worthy to be studied by themselves, but they offer great windows into the film.
Yeah. Especially if it's the films that you're watching that are part of the curriculum.
Yes. And there's a lot of good stuff written on Citizen Kane or Alfred Hitchcock. So some of them are fantastic essays.
Now, you also have film professionals participating.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
We've had a number of people coming in. I didn't go to a number of those talks that I had in another class at that time, but people talked about screenwriting, or one speaker talked about how one of Murnau's films was put together, and particularly drew attention to the physicality of the camera movement, certain things that we wouldn't have come across by ourselves. This coming summer, we're bringing in some people, for example, St. John's alum Sean Forrester will come to talk about composition. He's a teacher of art. He's an oil painter, runs an art institute in San Francisco and used to run one in Florence. But he will teach us about composition, which, from an artist's point of view. Godfrey Reggio, who directed the Koyanis Katsi series, there's going to be a showing of that, and he's going to come and give a talk.
And he's a Santa Fean.
Yes. Yeah, he's quite enthusiastic about it.
Very, very interesting. Yeah. Now, what have you learned by this? Has it changed your experience of film watching to be teaching the films in this way?
Yes, I think it has. I mean, I always watch films very intensely, and you know what happens with the St. John's seminar is that you go in with a 2D experience of the text, and you come out with a 3D experience of the text, right? You see it from many more sides than you would have come in, and it's a richer experience. So when you go into a film, nice thing about a film is that people can't hide behind the text. They can't just quote and hide behind the text. You know, they have to say what they thought they saw. And sometimes what they thought they saw was very different from what you thought you saw.
Now, in seminar, of course, you can refer back to page 73. And in the seminar with the film, I mean, do you have the film sitting there and you can show a clip of it?
Yes,
in class?
Right there. It's right there. Let's look at this. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So we might look at something for, several times. For example, to see what exactly was the expression of the face.
Yeah.
Yeah. What happened when they looked at each other?
Do you tend to watch films over and over again?
I do, yeah.
What are some of the films that you've watched the most?
Tarkovsky's Andrei Rublev.
And why?
It's so rich. It's so rich. I can watch it for 5 minutes and feel that I have a whole film.
Really?
Yeah, it's like eating.
It's like holographic?
In a way, it's like eating a good meal. You know, eating very good food, beautifully prepared. You don't have to eat that much to know that you're full.
Very
right. You might say, I've had enough. Okay, this is good. I'm going to savor it now. I don't need to be shoveling more in.
Yeah.
So one result for me of, say, my recent watching of films with the Film Institute people is that my viewing of films has become intenser. And I find I can take about 10, 15 minutes of a really great film, and then I have to slow down or stop and then chew over it. When I go to a commercial film, I find the experience anemic. You know, kind of it's not, there's just not that much going on.
Let's talk for a moment about commerce and art. I mean, the American film tradition is fundamentally commercial. It started as a commercial enterprise. The European film experience started as an artistic enterprise, and right there you've got a big difference.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and this is something that American directors have to, I think, work against, you know, because I'm not a great fan myself of the commercial cinema. I enjoy it. I don't think there's ever been a film that I haven't enjoyed. But it's that question of the satisfaction.
That's an amazing thing to say. There's never been a film you haven't enjoyed.
Yeah, I think that's true. There's always something in a film that will catch my attention, like somebody's face. Like, this person's really beautiful, you know, so I can watch this person. Or sometimes the cameraman is good. He manages to get the puddles of light beautifully. Or the location is interesting. And there's always something like that or some moment. Whereas, you know, a bad poem is quite simply unforgivable.
Right. I think that about films. There are some films I think should just be shot at dawn and never seen again by anyone.
Like what?
Well, I hate to say it, but The Passion of Christ. I hated that film.
You think it was bad?
That's another conversation I guess we'd have to have. Because it obviously had some great production values, but there are some that are far, far worse than that. And, I mean, you know, then there's the question of B and C and Z movies.
Right, yeah, yeah.
But when we talk about commercial films, are there any commercial films that you've seen, maybe American films, that you think reached the level of great films?
Hitchcock.
Yeah.
Right, you know, so Hitchcock, I mean, Psycho, for example, that's a great film. Vertigo, Rear Window, they grip you, they have layers, they have understanding of, you know, human obsession.
Right.
You know, that it's profound. Yeah, and he seemed to do it so effortlessly.
You know, one thing about Hitchcock is that, unlike many filmmakers, what I understand of the way he worked was every single frame was planned out before they started shooting. There was not an improvisational moment in the entire process.
That's right. It's amazing, isn't it? That kind of visual imagination.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas others, it comes together and the surprises make the film.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I've been working a lot with Charlie Chaplin recently. And not working a lot with him, I mean, in person. You know, right?
You know, yeah, we know that he's no longer here.
Yeah, but it's amazing to me there too how his kinetic imagination and memory is almost superhuman. How he can string together long sequences of motion that he has physically imagined beforehand. Right, and manages to make them perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Over a process that we may or may not know that much about. I mean, how many takes, how many tries did it take?
Yeah, yeah. And you can tell he's, for one of his shots, I think it took him 332 takes to get this 1 minute. So he had an idea in his head of the perfect thing.
Right. Now, what about films by, for example, the Marx Brothers, which are not in themselves great films, but it's some of the greatest comedy ever made?
Yeah, I love them. I mean, that would be an example of an author that is not necessarily the director.
Right.
Right, yeah.
It's these four guys.
Yeah, it's the four guys. They're the center of the film, the creative center of the film. Yeah.
Now, could you comment on, I mean, you sort of have referred to this a little bit, but this whole question of how films have changed us, how films have changed the general public, the way we see. They are very important in a way that, I mean, art has arguably become marginalized in many ways.
Yes.
And film is central to the way we understand ourselves. It's a huge change between, let's say, 19th and 20th century people.
Yeah, I think that's right. The striking thing is when you see a beginning of, a section of a film, then if I ask you, how else could this have been filmed? That immediately you will have five or six possibilities, right? I would have camera lower, camera moving from above, lighting different, you know, like that. You'd have ideas. If I asked you that about a Greek tragedy or an Elizabethan sonnet, your response would be, huh?
Very interesting. Right.
Yeah, so in a way it's in our blood. It's our creative medium.
And it's just because we've had so much exposure to it. Maybe we've read two or three Greek tragedies or one or none in our lives, but we've seen, I don't know how many films the average person has seen. It's uncountable.
It's uncountable, yeah. And yesterday in a group of my colleagues and I were discussing the erotic in 17th century French literature, where it is so intense and overwhelming. You know, one look and it's sexually overwhelming, you know, and we're trying to sort of excavate how that could be, and it dawned on us that it's a dimension of life that we have lost, a kind of intensity that we've lost because we're oversaturated with images of pretty people. Even in the 1920s and 30s, it would be reported that people would faint at the image of Greta Garbo on the screen. Right,
you know.
So think about like people passing out because a person is so beautiful. That doesn't happen anymore, right? You know, so it's become a much more tepid experience, maybe because of the oversaturation.
And so one wonders, what, if anything, can lead us to feel that kind of intensity?
Yeah, that's right. And I think the one way, in a way, is to dig out, you know, kind of scrape away the dirt. And, you know, in our seeing, and to be able to see a great film for what it is, like with fresh eyes, without the jadedness.
You know, I went to and watched the three films in the Santa Fe part of the Italian Film Festival recently, and they were all three amazing films. They were beautifully made and crafted, and there was a kind of emotional authenticity to them and a kind of craft which so beautifully mirrored what the films were about, some of the things that you're talking about. And some of them were light and one of them was quite heavy and one of them was light but had heavy themes. It was amazing. And I thought to myself as I was watching it, after I finished watching all three films, I thought, if I were a young American filmmaker, I would go on a fast and not watch any American films at all for one solid year and only watch, you know, European and Middle Eastern and Far Eastern and so on and African films that had that quality of authenticity and truth-telling.
Yeah.
In order to basically detoxify from the junky commercial stuff that's in, as you say, in our blood.
Yeah, I think that's a good plan. Yeah, no, detoxifying is that's a good way of putting it. Yeah, I mean, I was struck last year when in the last Film Institute, watching, say, filmmakers like Dreyer, Bresson, Murnau, how full of artistic integrity they were. You know, these are authentic films because these were the films that the makers made to express their vision, and they weren't going to compromise this to please people and to make money. You know, so failure was okay. And it was so refreshing to see this, you know, that somebody who so believed in their vision right? That they were willing to sacrifice so much to do this.
We're talking to Krishnan Venkatesh about the St. John's Summer Film Institute. What is the public component of it, and how do people find out more about it?
Well, you can Google St. John's College Film Institute, and that should take you to us. Or alternatively, call Scott Hannon at 984-6050, and he will give you information. Or come to the college and pick up materials.
And if people want to actually sign up and go, and there are various choices, there's also a screenwriting course, and there
yes.
are a couple of different four-week programs of the Film Institute. If people want to sign up for it, same thing.
Same thing. And if you're interested to find out more about how this thing can work and to actually sample it, there are two opportunities that are coming up soon. One is an evening on April 1st at the Great Hall at St. John's College, focused on the question, what is comedy? And we're going to study a short film by Buster Keaton, The Goat, which is hilarious. And it's a 20-minute film. We're going to watch it together, and then we're going to have a seminar on it. And it'll be a good introduction both to the Film Institute and to the college if you want to know more about it. So, and it's free. So please come April the 1st.
April 1st. April Fool's Day.
April Fool's Day. But we're not lying. And the other thing as a kind of sampler is that on March 14th and 15th, which is a weekend, I will be leading four seminars on three films by Kurosawa. And the theme is going to be The Warrior's Way. It's about the samurai.
Krishnan Venkatesh of St. John's College, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.